Greetings and rectilinear diagons, my magnanimously serapacious listeners, and welcome to this May 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this seriously hot mess of a science podcast segment, Jim Campanella.
I've got some good stuff for you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. You just hold on tight.
Sorry, I have no idea where that came from. First story of the night. A world's first. The world's first completely warm-blooded fish was reported in the journal Science a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Nicholas Wegner and his group at the NOAA Fisheries Southwest Science Center in San Diego wrote up the finding. The OPA, or moonfish, is an oval-shaped denizen of the deep that at first glance seems to be a sluggish and slow-moving fish, especially given its cold water habitat and its rather ungainly body design. The fish is flat and round, with relatively small fins and bright red, orange, and yellow scales. The OPA is also big. Wait, no, I meant OPA. OPA. The OPA is also big, with a diameter of a good 3 to 4 feet. You do not expect a big, sluggish fish to be warm-blooded. Well, actually, you don't really expect any fish to be warm-blooded for that matter, but Wegner has revealed this beautifully colored creature to be, quote, the first fully warm-blooded fish that circulates heated blood throughout its body, much like mammals and birds, giving it a competitive advantage in the cold ocean depths, unquote. Wegner explains in a news release that, quote, the OPA constantly flaps its fins in order to heat its blood and increase its metabolism, transforming the fish into a swift predator. Before this discovery, I was under the impression that this was a slow-moving fish, like most other in cold environments. But because it can warm its body, it turns out to be a very active predator that chases down agile prey like squid and can also migrate long distances, unquote. Additionally, the OPA has a unique gill design that allows for a phenomenon known as counter-current heat exchange. I actually remember this from my animal physiology class back in college. This process essentially involves warm blood leaving the body core to warm cold blood returning from the respiratory surfaces of the gills, where the oxygen is absorbed. Great white sharks are also considered warm-blooded, but not completely warm-blooded. There are limits, apparently, on its physiology, and the mechanisms are quite different from the OPA. Wegner says, quote, there has never been anything like this seen in a fish's gills before. It works like a car's radiator. This is a cool innovation and gives fish a huge competitive edge. We believe that the elevated body temperature enhances muscle output and also boosts brain and eye function, unquote. I actually recognized this fish when I saw the photo. I remember it, though, by the moonfish title. When I was a kid, some gas stations used to give out animal trading cards when you bought gas. Yes, it was a long time ago. I remember the moonfish from among this very strange collection of animals that I had never seen before. I remember it's a solitary swimmer, and it gathers in groups only during spawning. It swims pretty deep down, 150 to 1,000 feet, and it's sometimes found in the vicinity of feeding tuna. According to the article, I guess that it's quite tasty and a serious prize for marine sports fishermen. The article says that last summer off Baja California, several OPA catches were logged, including one that weighed 180 pounds and was recently approved as the world record. Told you that OPAs were big. Sorry, OPAs. Boy, I'm going to get emails on this podcast, aren't I? Next story. What makes our brains male or female? Can we point to any particular genetic process that alters the brain during development to help ensure that we do not have gender dysphoria? Gender dysphoria is a disconnect between how we perceive our gender and our actual gender. Notice I'm trying to be very scientific in my phrasing here. I'm being careful because people are very offended on both sides of the aisle if you are not careful in your language. Dr. Bridget Nugent of the University of Maryland and her colleagues have written up results in Nature Neuroscience, and they did this last month, and the paper looks closely at genetics and the process of brain gender development. Just as in physical development by default, mammalian brains develop as female, with telltale structural elements that differ from a male brain. It's only when male hormones reach the brain, late in fetal development and shortly after birth, that the organ starts to take on a quote-unquote masculine look. Nugent says that it has been long assumed that the hormones must directly act on a host of genes to force these changes toward the masculine, but new research suggests otherwise. Her team now reports that gonadal steroids indirectly turn on brain masculinization genes by blocking DNA methylation throughout the genome. Now let's make a quick side note explanation of methylation and gene regulation for just a moment. DNA, as you guys remember, has four bases, G, A, T, and C. And it is possible to attach what are called methyl groups to the C base. Now, a methyl group is a very simple chemical molecule. It's a carbon with three hydrogens attached to it. That's all. Now, when methyls are attached to DNA, attached specifically to the C-type base, it changes the topology of the DNA, and the DNA squishes up like an accordion. This makes it very hard for the DNA to be read or the genes to be turned on. You can kind of compare it to a book. You take a book and you close its covers. The genes become inaccessible, just like the words inside the book become inaccessible once the covers are closed. You've changed the topology of the book and you can't read it. Same thing. You change the topology of the DNA and the DNA can't be read. And the genes are essentially turned off in that area. Demethylation has the opposite effect. It changes topology, it opens up DNA, and it makes the genes accessible to being read. This is a complex, long-term regulation of genes. It can even occur across generations, and that has really only been discovered in the last 10 years or so. Back to the brain. For most of gestation, the developing brains of a male and a female fetus look pretty much the same. And that makes sense. After all, most of the functions of the brain are the same between the sexes. But around the time of birth, a male fetus gets a sudden rush of testosterone. And over the following days, some areas of the brain begin to change by getting larger or adding new populations of neurons. Nugent says, quote, "There are some regions, especially those involved in sexual behaviors, that are extremely dimorphic. One particularly obvious change is that star-shaped astrocytes in the preoptic area, which have roles in male copulatory behavior, grow more branches," unquote. A few days after birth, the changes that make a brain male are established, and they persist until adulthood, when hormone levels rise again. Nugent says, quote, "It is striking to us that a very brief and fleeting hormone surge in development is able to completely program sex differences in the brain," unquote. It turns out that methylation is the key to all this. Remember, I said that methylation is a long-term regulatory system. Well, Nugent looked at exactly that. They wondered whether epigenetic changes affecting the methylation of genes could be responsible for flipping the switch between a male and female brain. They measured levels of DNA methyltransferase, the enzyme that adds the methyl groups to the DNA to turn down expression, in male and female rat pups, as well as female pups treated with hormones to induce masculinization. A few days after birth, the activity of DNA methyltransferase was drastically lower in both the male and the masculinized female pups. When Nugent and her group looked at global methylation levels in the pups, they found that females had nearly twice the level of fully methylated Cs than males. And female pups that received male hormones during the critical first few days of life had similar levels of methyltransferase activity and overall methylation as males. They also resembled male pups in the spine density of astrocytes in the preoptic area of the brain, that telltale sign of masculinization. To test whether DNA methyltransferase was responsible for the full masculinization of the brain, a group of Nugent's collaborators at Mount Sinai School of Medicine blocked the enzyme in female rat pups. Not only did the density in astrocyte spines in the preoptic area increase, But female rats also started performing male-like sexual behaviors, quote, thrusting at and mounting other animals, unquote. The major finding, in essence, means that the female brain isn't just a default state. It's a repressed version of the male brain. When that repression is lifted in the form of blocked methyltransferase, and therefore less methylation, then the male brain develops. But Nugent wasn't done yet. Previous theories about the brain's masculinization assumed that once a brain was set as male or female, the programming wasn't reversible. But Nugent's group decided to question that belief as well. First, they exposed female pups that were 10 days old, well past the window when sexual differentiation is complete, to male hormones. The females were not affected since the time window for hormones to act on methyltransferase had presumably closed. But then, the researchers gave the female pups a drug that directly blocked the enzyme. The females' brains and behaviors started resembling males, evidence that the brain sexualization, while it normally only occurs in a brief window of time, isn't so set as stone as was once believed. Nugent concludes with, quote, sex and gender is really a continuum. There are shades of gray in there, unquote. She refuses to comment on how all this may work in human brain gender development and if methylation can be altered and changed in humans. Think about that and think about the potential for what's being suggested here. I am not going to go there. I am not going to discuss it, again, for fear of all the emails that I may get, but think about it for just a moment. Next story, blood. Blood typing and low supplies of rare blood types may soon become a thing of the past. Everyone's blood can soon essentially make everyone a universal donor. Blood of an incompatible type, no matter how abundant, would not help you at all if you were transfused with it. You would suffer a severe, potentially fatal immune response. But what if blood of one type could be changed into blood of another type? Blood type is determined by the sugar antigens found on your particular blood cells. If you can strip off those sugar antigens from the blood cells, then anybody could use that blood, no matter what their blood type, because there would be no antigens, no chemicals to interact with the immune system. The possibility of stripping off those antigenic chemicals from red blood cells has intrigued scientists for a long time. And in recent years, they've even made some progress. They come up with an enzyme that snips off those sugars that sprout from the red blood cells. When the enzyme acts on red blood cells from type A and B blood, they become more like blood cells from type O. And type O is a universal donor. It does not cause an immune response when given to people with type A, B, or AB blood. Now, the problem to date with this method of stripping off sugars is that it is not very practical. It is both inefficient and uneconomical. However, this process may no longer be infeasible. Recent work by Dr. Steve Withers at the University of British Columbia was described back in April in the Journal of the American Chemical Society. To create a high-powered version of the antigen-stripping enzyme, Withers used a technology called directed evolution that involves inserting mutations into the gene that codes for the enzyme and then selecting mutants that are more effective at cutting the antigens. In just 5 generations of alterations, Withers was able to create a cutting enzyme that's 170 times more effective than the original. Withers wrote, quote, enzymatic removal of the A or B antigens yields universal O-type blood, but is inefficient. Starting with a glycoside hydrolase from the bacteria Streptococcus pneumoniae, which cleaves the entire terminal trisaccharide antigenic determinants from some of the linkages on the red blood cell surface, we developed variants with vastly improved activity towards some of the linkages that are resistant to cleavage by the wild-type enzyme, unquote. With the new and improved enzyme, Withers and his group were able to remove most of the antigens in type A and B blood, which is very cool. However, before the blood could be used in a clinical setting in hospitals to create type-free blood, It would have to be capable of removing all the antigens. The immune system is highly sensitive to blood groups, and even small amounts of residual antigens could trigger an immune response problem. Withers, however, says that he is confident that, quote, we can take this a whole lot further and make the enzyme even more efficient, unquote. The last two stories of the night are kind of related to each other insofar as they are about identifying people using new genetic techniques. The first story actually dates back to November and was published in the journal Biotechniques, but it was when I read it last week that I knew I had to share it with you, even though it's a little on the older side. The title was, quote, DNA Profiles from Finger Marks, unquote. That's a very simple title, but it's actually quite interesting, quite amazing. Anyone who watches any CSI show knows that fingerprints are kind of old hat. Sure, fingerprints are employed in criminal investigations and in courts of law, but they are just not sexy anymore. In the last 30 years, a huge number of cold cases have been solved using DNA fingerprinting evidence, where genetic markers particular to an individual were used to identify and convict criminal suspects. Since its first use as a forensic tool in the 1980s, DNA analysis has become the gold standard of evidence in criminal justice. Recent improvements in DNA purification and amplification techniques have made it much easier to obtain reliable DNA profiles from minimal sample material. The next generation of sequencing technologies are identifying new targets that will yield markers more specific for individual suspects, as well as allow the collection and sharing of these data through centralized databases. Given its simplicity, PCR is ideally suited for forensics, since it provides exquisite sensitivity of detection and enables a genotype to be generated very quickly. PCR is a method that enzymatically copies DNA in a matter of an hour or two. This process allows investigators to rule suspects in or out within the few hours it takes to perform and analyze the reaction. Well, at least that's how it works on CSI. My cop friends assure me that in practical terms, it may take weeks to get crime lab results, simply because labs are often swamped with a huge number of requests. At any rate, sample preparation protocols and contamination by others who may have handled the sample or were present at the crime scene can make it difficult to interpret the results. The low amounts of DNA that investigators have to work with are also rather problematic. Doctors Jennifer Templeton and Adrian Lineaker at Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia, recently addressed these issues in the biotechnique paper that I mentioned earlier. In their study, they used PCR to profile DNA collected directly from swabs of fingerprints. Yes, they isolated and analyzed DNA short tandem repeats directly from fingerprints. They didn't need tissues, they didn't need hairs, they didn't need anything except for the fingerprint. This is a massive step forward in crime detection. Lineaker says, quote, there is latent DNA on things that you can't see, such as doorknobs, knife handles, etc. Currently, you need to do a DNA extraction where you lose up to 80% of the DNA, even with the best methods, so you end up with insufficient template to do anything. The only way to get it to work is if you boost the number of cycles, which a lot of labs don't like to do. Cycles refers to the number of cycles in PCR that are done. Others have been able to amplify fingerprint DNA using PCR with increased numbers of cycles for low copy number detection. But if you increase the number of cycles, that introduces errors that include misdetection of targets and overamplification of a target. Templeton and Lineaker decided to do direct PCR on DNA from swabs of fingerprints collected from all five fingers of 34 volunteers, and they were able to generate interpretable profiles for 71% of the 170 swabs using the Profiler Plus and NGM Select STR typing kits, which are very popular among the police. Lineaker came up with the idea to try direct PCR on swabs from earlier work where he and his colleagues generated DNA fingerprinting profiles from human hairs. He says, quote, if you take 2 millimeters of your hair from the proximal end every hair will generate a full profile. This made me think that we could also get it from finger marks, unquote. Leinecker's group used a positively charged swab to collect negatively charged DNA. The approach was so effective that the researchers did not need to extract the DNA. They simply placed the fibers from the swab into a PCR tube and performed the recommended number of PCR cycles to generate the profiles. Leinecker concludes with, quote, "We wanted to do it as forensic labs currently do with commercial kits so that it will be easy to implement. This also reduces the chances of swapping things up and greatly reduces cost. When we started a few years ago, I thought this was already done. I'm not going to take any great praise for this because it was patently obvious," unquote. Not everything is patently obvious, but it's nice that he thinks it's patently obvious. Last story. All right, here's a fantasy. Bob and Fred are brothers, genetically identical twins, who came from the same split ova, what we call monozygotic twins. Bob commits a heinous crime. Fred has no alibi, and his brother is a sociopath. Bob pays off some people to create an alibi. Additionally, Bob insists that Fred did it since genetic evidence was left at the crime scene to prove it was him. Is it possible to tell apart DNA from genetically identical individuals? Can we bring the evil Bob to justice? You think this is just a silly hypothetical. This could never happen. Well, think again. This conundrum isn't just my own inane dramatic device. In a rape case currently winding its way through the court systems of Boston, Massachusetts, an indictment only came after authorities spent over $100,000 to use a recently developed second-generation genome mapping technique to exclude the suspect's twin as a match. And this isn't the only instance where the inability to distinguish between twins has hindered law enforcement. DNA sequences of identical twins should, in theory, be identical, but DNA replication is not error-free, and other mutations can also arise during development. One simple but brute force approach for differentiating between twins is to simply sequence the whole genome. I mean, there are minor base pair alterations even in monozygotic twins. You look at the whole genome and you'll be able to see those. If such a mutation is identified at a particular location in the twin, then that same particular mutation can be specifically searched for in the crime scene sample. However, this is very expensive and time-consuming and is unlikely to be paid for by cash-strapped police forces. How do you make this cheaper and easier for police departments to perform themselves? Dr. Graham Williams at the University of Huddersfield in the UK recently published a story in the journal Analytical Biochemistry that focuses not quite so much on twin DNA, but on epigenetic changes in the DNA. Yes, we are back to DNA methylation, our very first story of the evening. Williams and his colleagues have now developed a faster method for detecting DNA methylation differences, which can be altered by environmental factors in pairs of identical twins. The new approach is called high-resolution melt curve analysis. Williams says, quote, "What HRMA does is to subject the DNA to increasingly high temperatures until the hydrogen bonds holding the two strands of DNA together melt and break. This is known as the melting temperature. The more hydrogen bonds that are present in the DNA, the higher the temperature required to melt them apart. Consequently, if one DNA sequence is more methylated than the other, then the melting temperature of the two samples will be different, a difference which can be measured and which will establish the difference between two identical twins." Unquote. To test the method, Williams isolated DNA from cheek swabs collected from five sets of identical twins. The researchers were able to distinguish between all five pairs of twins using melting curves from amplification products for the ALU-E2F3 locus. However, only four of the five sets of twins were able to be told apart by melting curves from another locus, the ALUSP locus. This indicates that genetic location selection might be critical for effective analysis. The largest difference in melting temperatures was seen for the oldest set of twins, though the data overall did not show a clear relationship between methylation differences and age. The authors acknowledged that environmental effects on DNA methylation over time, which is the basis of this test, could actually be a significant drawback if, for example, samples collected years ago are tested against samples gathered in the present day. This limits the usefulness of the approach on cold cases. In addition, since DNA methylation patterns can also vary in different body fluids from the same individual, samples originating from one bodily fluid should be tested against DNA taken from the same bodily fluid. Despite these limitations, the HRMA method represents a significant milestone. Williams says, quote, "We have demonstrated substantial progress toward a relatively cheap and quick test for differentiating between identical twins in forensic casework," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Be wary of evil twins. If you're an evildoer, leave lots of fingerprints. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.